And welcome back to A Closer Look. I'm Rose Scott.
And I'm Dennis O'Hare. Later today, for the first time since the mid-40s, the state of Georgia is scheduled to execute a woman. Kelly Gissendanner is set to die by lethal injection for arranging the murder of her husband back in 1997 in Gwinnett County. Now, last week, the State Board of Pardons and Parole denied clemency for Gissendanner. The Reverend Kathy Zappa is an Episcopal priest who works with some of Georgia's female inmates and has worked with Kelly Gissendanner. She's also the canon for spirituality and mission at the Cathedral of St. Philip here in Atlanta. Reverend Zappa joins us now in our studios. Reverend Zappa, welcome. Good to have you.
Thank you.
Kelly Gissendanner herself has expressed remorse. She has earned a continuing certificate in theological studies. This is a woman who didn't come into prison that way. She was an angry, violent person. What was the transformation for her? Has she talked about that?
She's talked about it. I didn't know her when she first came into prison, so I really know the later Kelly.
Yeah, this was by her own admission.
Right. She says, I was cocky, I was arrogant, I was selfish. And that's what some of the volunteer chaplains who worked with her early on have said as well. I don't know what moment changed things for her. I just know that over time she was able to look back at what she did. As she was able to face what she had done, her life really began to turn around. She did get involved in the Certificate in Theological Studies program, which gave her a venue for wrestling with what she'd done and, you know, what life is and what sin is and suffering and a lot of those really hard questions.
Did she say anything about facing what she had done and what that moment was like for her?
I think she's faced it several times over a long period of time. Again, there's not one moment that we can point to and say, oh, this turned her around. Mm-hmm.
I think, on the remorse side, you have to, when you've done something like this, you have to, and it apparently she has, faced the reality that you have or helped arrange the murder of your husband, the father of your children.
Right. And I think that's one of the things that's so painful for her. She cannot undo what she did. She can't undo it for him. She can't undo it for his parents. She can't undo it for her children, who are also victims in this. And I think that's part of why she's lived her life the way she has since. She's living her life as someone who is remorseful and wants to offer everything she can. She can't undo it. She can't make it go away. She can't make the Gissendanner's pain go away. But the most she can do is offer what's left of her life.
Obviously, somebody listening might say, if she has made a genuine conversion in her life, that's wonderful. And from a theological point of view, that's great for her soul. But what would you say to somebody who would say, okay, there is still a price to be paid, and that is why we have capital punishment?
Absolutely. There is a price to be paid, and she's not trying to get out of paying that price. She's served 18 years. She is not probably ever going to leave. She's never going to leave prison. All she's asking for is a chance to live and to live in prison. And one thing you may have heard already is what a powerfully positive influence she's been in the prison with the inmates, with the staff, with people from the outside who come in. I work with a lot of seminarians who come in and teach, and they've all been transformed by their interactions with her. So I think what she's hoping for, she and I had a conversation recently that she just feels like God's work in her and through her is not done. She has a real sense of, I have something to give, let me give it.
Reverend, let's back up a little bit here. In talking about this road to being remorseful, talk about the first time you met Kelly, and sort of, you know, how you've seen her go through this transition.
When I first met Kelly, I actually met her a little bit from a distance. I was a seminarian at Candler School of Theology, and I was teaching a class in this theology program, and she wasn't in my class, but I saw her, you know, she'd come into the room when I left. And so I saw her with other inmates, and it was a classroom environment. She always had to have officers with her. And they'd either be in the room or out right outside the door where they could see in through the glass. So you knew she was there. You knew that there was something different about her. But she was just one of the people in the room. The first time I went and talked to her by myself, I was nervous. It was more just the nervousness of I'm going to be sitting with her for an hour and a half. What are we going to talk about?
Mm-hmm.
You know, just the same nervousness you'd have with someone else. And then also knowing this seriousness of why she's there and what she's facing. Am I equipped to walk in and be with this person? But I had no, I never was scared of her. I mean, she's just...
What'd you talk about?
Well, it was a little bit of just getting to know each other, but we did the first study and also what we wanted to study, but the first thing that we did together, she had been corresponding with a German theologian, Jürgen Moltmann. She had come across his work in one of her earlier classes, and she had asked the teacher, can I write him? He has a public address, so the teacher said, yeah, that's fine. And he wrote back, and they'd been corresponding ever since. And because of their correspondence, he had agreed to come and speak at our theology graduation at the prison. So since he was coming and she was finally get to meet him one-on-one, we took one of his books and we were going to really study him. And so we were studying his theology of hope. So we spent a lot of time talking about what hope really is. And, you know, what does hope look like in a situation where you're never going to leave prison? Again, you can't change what you've already done. You can't go back and make it go away or bring Doug, Giss, and Danner back. But also, what does it look like when you're facing death? And, you know, hope was not, she didn't see it as this naive optimism that I'm going to get what I want and it's all going to be okay. It was, how do I live this life? And I actually have something she wrote about it. Can I read that?
Sure.
She wrote this later, but I think this came out of some of that early work we did. Here at Alto, there's broken people who, in the course of living their difficult lives, find powerful connection and even love. I use the metaphor of the mosaic to help others see the process of making something beautiful from what is broken. Mosaics remind me that broken pieces are not made whole by trying to glue pieces back together again, aiming for perfection we imagine we once displayed. Rather, when we allow our brokenness to be seen in new ways, when we accept that others are also broken and we love them anyway, and when we cease to view brokenness as ugly and unacceptable, healing becomes possible. Rather than aiming for paradise somewhere over the rainbow, we are challenged instead to create something with the brokenness, not in spite of it. We're called to use our own broken places, our tragedies, our shameful truths, our unhealed wounds, to create beauty where we can. This is the task of the religious life, not to imagine some faraway paradise that only the perfect can enter, nor to give up on possibilities and sit passively in misery. Rather, we are called to transform the painful and harsh realities of our lives into as much beauty as we can and to find ways to help each other heal. I think that sort of captures how she sees hope.
When you meet with inmates mm-hmm. for the first time, or I don't know if it's in a group setting or one-on-one, how much of it do you go in with the mindset of, I need to maybe come in with scriptures or prayer or a Bible-based sort of, yeah. not a sermon, but a Bible-based message, or you just sort of listen for the first time?
I'm there really in two capacities. One is as this theology teacher and director of this theology program.
Sure.
The theology program is modeled on what a lot of seminaries are like. You're not there to learn a party line or to learn a certain way of interpreting different biblical stories. You're there to learn how you interpret, and you're there to learn what your voice is and what God has sort of placed in you to discover. So our approach is to present a lot of different perspectives and to help the women develop the confidence and some of the skill to do that theological and interpretive work themselves. I do have a Bible, but I'm not forcing people to read it the way I do.
Sure.
And we actually have women who are not Christians in our program. It's a Christian theology program that we start with Christian theology. We do have, you know, we talk about who and what Jesus Christ is. We use language like sin, but we have Muslims in there and we have atheists, and we tend to just attract a lot of seekers, people who want to deepen their relationship with God, however they understand God.
You anticipate a little bit of what I was going to ask you about mm-hmm. your initial approach to inmates, whether it's someone on death row or
right.
not, which is, do you go in there as a missionary, in a sense, looking to win souls who
yeah.
might have been lost to violence or whatever?
Mm-hmm.
Or are you in there to be primarily a pastor seeking to meet the needs that you see there? Or is it a combination of both?
It's really neither. I do not go in as a missionary seeking to win souls. Those women are missionaries to me and to a lot of the people who come in from the outside.
How so?
First of all, some people come in from the outside thinking, you know, I'm going to bring Jesus. I'm going to show them Jesus and show them the way. Not all the women, but a lot of those women know Jesus. They know the Bible better than I know it as a priest.
Really, but because they've been reading it or?
A lot of them have been reading it. They've been living it. You know, a lot of times when you're in jail, you can't have other readings, so you have the Bible. Prison's different. They have access to other reading. But these women teach me about faith. I mean, it's very easy for me to sit, you know, in a church, sit in my house, sit in seminary, which is a privilege in and of itself, and talk about faith. It's a very different thing to talk about what faith means when you just lost your appeal or, you know, your child's struggling on the outside and you can't do anything about it, or your mom dies and you're in prison and you can't be there with her or even go to the funeral. It's a very different thing to talk about faith.
Because I think a lot of people might say, this is not the kind of atmosphere they would expect in a prison. They
right.
would expect it would be, and they have seen a lot of shows, for instance, mm-hmm. fictional and otherwise, that basically portray it as a place of total despair.
And it's
I think
not.
They give it a bad perception.
Yeah.
One could argue that.
Yeah.
Some of
outside
those,
images?
Some, yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, those outside images help us keep people there. You know, there are ways to say these people are somehow different from us. Mm-hmm. But when you get in there, you realize, no, these are human beings who are somehow managing to hold on to faith and hold on to hope and hold on to their dignity in spite of all this, in spite of the shame they feel about what they've done. In the case of women, most of them have been abused before they ever got there. I mean, there are whole histories that bring people there. So to return to you asked if I go in as a missionary, mm-hmm. no. And what was the other
the
part
other
of that?
The other part of it was, do you go in then as, okay, I'm not going
to
win souls, but are you there to teach in your case?
Right.
Or to meet needs that already exist?
Right.
Without saying, okay, I'm going to win somebody over who might be an atheist, for instance.
Right. Meeting needs is language that's hard because it implies that I have all the power and I can come in and you know, be superwoman or the fairy godmother, and we can't do that. In fact, there are a lot of, one of the frustrating things about working in the prison, and I think it's the same thing with working on the streets anywhere, you can't meet the need. I mean, I can't, you know, the woman whose mom died, I can't get her to that funeral. I can't make any of that pain go away. It's more of showing up and loving people and being willing to be present with them through this in this very difficult time. And I think the theology program has been a way for me to be present and to help people. It's just given people room to wrestle with some of these things. And we also have an Episcopal service out there. And that also, with the liturgy and just the way it's a smaller group, that's also been a way that people, of just being present with people.
When you appeared before the Georgia Board of Pardons and Parole on Kelly's behalf, was the fundamental message about how much she had changed, or was it something along the lines of she deserved to be spared because it's the Christian thing to do?
We're talking about how you hear what you want to hear.
Sure.
But it was a lot about how much she's changed and how much good she's doing. She has been a model inmate. And she is really the poster child of what the Department of Corrections is trying to do, which is rehabilitation. You know, there's a lot of talk about the good that she's doing in prison. If somebody's acting out and having a really hard time, a lot of times they are very intentionally put in the cell by Kelly. And I
really?
Know, yes, I know one woman who, she was very suicidal. She's what's called a cutter. You know, she cuts
mm-hmm.
herself.
Yes.
So she was put in a suicide watch in a cell near Kelly. And Kelly spoke to her through the vent and said, don't give up your power. Live the life that God has you to live. Don't give up on the life that you have to live. And that woman, I mean, credits her turn to what Kelly said to her through the vent. And Kelly continued to be encouraging to her. Kelly encouraged her to apply to the theology program, which she did. And she graduated a year or two after Kelly did. Those kinds of stories, there are so many stories like that. So it's well known in the prison that she's a positive influence, and so many people look up to her.
This was your first time testifying, I guess, in a sense, on behalf of a death row inmate.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about that experience? And I know you can't say exactly what was said inside of the hearing, but that experience for you, that's a lot of pressure, I imagine, Reverend.
That was a lot of pressure. And the experience was, it was very stressful because it is a heavy matter. And I had submitted a letter to her attorneys that was turned in with a big, they had tons of letters that were written on her behalf. So that prepared me a little bit, and I sat down and tried to think through some major talking points, but I didn't want to come in and read a statement. And so I found myself really regretting that when I got in there because I realized how intimidated I was. And I can't talk much about what was said in there, except it was a celebration of a woman. I mean, it was just testimony after testimony after testimony about the difference that this woman has made from death row in prison. And about the remorse she's felt. I mean, all of it is tied up together. Her remorse is part of the reason that she's so committed to giving of herself now.
Has she talked at all, and maybe this is something that is just between you and Kelly Gissendaner, but has she talked at all about what she might be thinking the moment where she's facing her death?
She has. She's scared to death. She's been writing and talking about that for a long time. She's had dreams and nightmares about it. It's a scary thing to face. But I will say, you know, she found out on Wednesday that she'd been denied clemency. She has been so strong. And, you know, keep saying what she's been saying all along is that nothing can take away her hope, faith, and dignity. So
even if she were to die,
mm-hmm.
you mentioned earlier that her work would continue. Does she feel that her work would continue after her death?
It will continue through the people she's touched. And it's not just the inmates. There's a prison prevention program where they bring at-risk youth into different prisons and they can talk to different inmates. They've been bringing at-risk youth to see her for 15 years. And they have a lot of letters about people she's touched in that way, too. So, yes, the people she's already affected, that work will continue through them. I think one of the hardest things that would not be able to continue, and this is part of what's so tragic about it, is her relationship with her children.
Someone listening may say, well, my goodness, prison ministry in general has got to be difficult, just in general.
Yeah.
Because you're dealing with so many different individuals. And again, we talked about perception.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly because of all the debates and policy about whether it's death row or just how we treat and manage our correctional facilities in general. How are you able to balance all of that and then what you're tasked to do and what you feel like you've been called to do inside of a correctional facility with some people who may not belong there or with people who definitely belong there and who've, as Dennis put it, have done some bad things, some really bad things?
It has become part of my spiritual practice. You know, my title at the cathedral is Canon for Spirituality and Mission, and to me those two are totally intertwined. And I go out there on Monday night for the Episcopal service, and I'm in charge, I'm on duty, and yet I leave feeling like I've really worshipped and really been ministered to. So there's something about it that feeds me. And I said before, these women really are my teachers.
What have you learned? You did mention that before. What have you learned?
This gets at what's hard about it, too. What's hard about it, and you know, in a case with Kelly, for example, this is a woman who has been involved in a murder. And, you know, holding on to that and thinking about the parents of her victim and thinking about her victim and also loving her. And, I mean, it is a hard thing to balance sometimes. And so I have to keep reminding myself, I know one side of this story, and I know there's more to the story. Personally, I need that because I don't ever want to become really complacent in the way that I see things. I don't ever want to really feel like I've got God in a box. You know, I've got my theology in a box. And so I need to be an environment that keeps pushing me and raising questions for me. And that's what this environment does. It raises a lot of questions. One thing that's hard about it is what we were talking about before. Sometimes you can't even help. You know, it can be a very helpless feeling. You walk into the prison And you also are vulnerable, not to the women, but just to the whole system.
You mentioned Doug Gissendanner's mm-hmm. parents. Mm-hmm. They have issued a long statement about this where it just says they want to remember him.
Right.
They're not planning to be at the execution, for mm-hmm. instance. I don't know if you've had any contact with them or whether that's even appropriate, but if you could speak to them,
yeah.
what would you say?
I don't understand. I can't say I understand how much they're hurting, but I respect it. I have major respect for it. And I'm mad at Kelly too. I mean, we all are.
Yeah, because that's part of, I think, what a lot of people particularly support the death penalty,
right.
I'd say, is do people who work with inmates ever feel angry at them for what they've done?
Yes. And that's one of the things that's hard about being in that environment is remembering, you know, we don't live in a black and white world. We don't have those absolutes that we'd like to have where you can say, this person's good and this person's bad. This is where guilt is and this is where innocence is. And it's hard to be in the middle of that sometimes, to be able to say, I love this person, but I know she's done something really awful. But for the Gissendanners, I mean, it's just, again, executing her is not going to bring him back. In fact, it makes this, and they probably have no intention of ever reconciling with her, and understandably so. But if they ever did just need to say their piece or something like that, she's not going to be there for that. And whereas if she stays in prison, she's in prison. She's not coming out. And then there are her children. And talk about being in the middle. Her children are mm-hmm. victims of the crime also.
Her daughter was 6, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I don't know the exact age, but mm-hmm. they were all young. They are victims of this crime. And they have also suffered. And he's their dad also. He was a great father, from what I understand. And I just don't think he'd want his kids to suffer any more than they already have. I feel silly even saying anything because their grief is so much deeper than anything I can even speak to.
When you were speaking to the Board of Pardons and Parole, again, as Rose said, we can't talk about what was said in a closed hearing.
Mm-hmm.
But did you get the feeling that the members of the board really understood all of these conflicting deep emotions?
And I don't want to answer that.
Okay.
Before you wrap up, Reverend, do you do any research or background information on any of the inmates that you work with to get a better feel for mm-hmm. what they have gone through or how they got there to the correctional facility? And does that help you at all? And are you allowed to do that, I guess?
You can't. I mean, a lot of it's public. I don't until I get to know them. And that's what I tell. I work with other student teachers who come in and I tell them the same thing.
Really?
Yes.
Because you don't want them to go in with some preconceived judgment or...
I don't know why. I just think you have to get to know people first and get to know them where they are first. And then within the context of that relationship, you can look back and you can get into those muddy waters. But Barbara Brown Taylor came and spoke at one of our other graduations.
She's a pastor from North Georgia, and former President Carter thinks she's one of the best preachers mm-hmm. in the world.
Yeah, I do too. But she's a very thoughtful writer. And she, in her address to the students, it was called, she wrote The Danger of a Single Story, and it was based on something she'd read by somebody else, I can't remember. But I remember her talking about, to the women in there, you're not defined by that single story. You are not that moment in your past. And that's how I feel about the women in the prison. And that's why I think sometimes get to know the person now, get a sense of the whole person. And then if you feel like you need to, you can look at the crime. A lot of times they'll end up telling us about it once we have a relationship with them. So, not in detail.
Sure.
These women are getting out, most of them. Kelly Gissendanner isn't. But most of the women that you might run into are eventually going to get out of prison and move into some sort of life afterward. Is that on your mind when you are working with those who are going to get out? Because mm-hmm. that's such a critical question. How are they going to make the adjustment with some sort of spiritual grounding
right.
to a life that's going to challenge them every minute once they get out?
Yes, that is on my mind in some ways, but I want to be clear. I don't know how many of the women, I work with a lot of women who have life without parole, or several, I won't say a lot, and I work with a lot of women who have life. So I don't get too into the distinctions of who is getting out soon and who's not. And life still has value, even if you're still in the prison. And you can still do good work. You can do ministry. You can do a lot within prison. So that's, you can be a leader in the prison, a positive leader. When it comes to the women leaving, yeah, it's extraordinarily difficult. It's hard to find a job. It's hard to get people to give you a chance with a job or housing. You know, somebody who's been in prison for 22 years and they're released, they've never seen a cell phone. They don't really know how to use a computer. It's a major life adjustment. And the Department of Corrections and the governor's office are working on making that transition easier. But I think we have an obligation, for me as a faith community, to be there in that liminal moment for those people too.
Well, now, on the other end of that, counseling someone who's coming in for the first time with the realization they're going to be here mm-hmm. for the remainder of their life as well.
Yeah.
That's got to be challenging.
It is. And I don't know that I counsel, you know, in the sense of a traditional sense. But again, you meet people where they are. You don't have to come in with the answer. And I think something that intimidates a lot of people from doing this kind of ministry is thinking, oh, I wouldn't know what to say. You don't have to know what to say. You know, you learn a lot from the people you're with.
I'm curious with the younger women, probably under the age of, let's say, 25, mm-hmm. Who've been given mm-hmm. long sentences. Is there a difference in the program's approach then? If you don't want to call it counseling, the program's yeah. approach to that younger generation as opposed to someone who might be coming in their 40s or who's yeah. already been there for a long time?
Not in our program and not in the Episcopal service. I can't speak to the Department of Corrections programming. But no, we have a woman I know who was 20. She was at least 21. She might have been 20. I remember her saying she was the youngest one to go through the theology program. And then we have people who are in their upper 60s or 70. That's the thing about this environment is that every culture has its own subculture. And
sure.
so there are all these dynamics there, but it's also a huge equalizer. I mean,
yes, it is.
Yeah.
You're correct.
Yeah. So no, we don't approach people differently. Again, because it's a theology, it's an academic program. So we have our class, we have our syllabus, and everybody's expected to do the same work.
As a theology teacher, and as a priest,
mm-hmm.
you're wrestling with concepts of justice mm-hmm. and mercy,
mm-hmm.
sometimes contradictory forces, which are not just legal things. These are biblical things.
Right.
These are something in the Judeo-Christian tradition, which are emphasized a lot.
Mm-hmm.
How has this experience helped you learn about that sometimes tension?
Yeah.
In the spiritual world between justice and mercy?
I'm still learning about it, is the first answer. But I'm understanding God's justice as very different from our human conceptions of justice, that justice is not always tit for tat. It's not always even about fairness.
That's interesting. Why?
Part of it is that's that whole thing of we can make it right. You know, that justice implies we can fix things. We can make things even. You know, if I give you a little more and you a little less, then we're all good. And that, to me, is not how justice works. I mean, God's justice is very much tied up with God's mercy. You think about the story of David and Nathan, mm-hmm. And David has committed this egregious sin. He's committed adultery. He's had Uriah killed. And Nathan comes up to him and, you know, calls him out on it and says, you are the man. And that's the turning point for David. I mean, that moment of judgment, of justice, actually gives David a second chance. I mean, I see that as tied up in God's mercy. That is God stopping him in his self-destructive tracks and in the, you know, his destructive tracks.
You mentioned people of all different beliefs and faith within the system, but for a non-believer.
Mm-hmm.
Who comes to you and says, or you know, who has a hard time mm-hmm. understanding any connection to whether it be religion mm-hmm. or spiritual, whatever, what have you. So then how do you handle that?
Really the same way. I use different language, but I...
Like what?
Well, for example, there's a woman who I think the world of, and she comes to the Episcopal service. She's one of the most faithful attendees at the Episcopal service. She's been through the theology program. She has just grabbed hold of it. And in fact, she did a presentation in one of our classes about suffering and was really raising the question, I have trouble believing in God because of all this suffering. Where was God when? Where is God now? I mean, questions that I think all of us have. And her raising those questions gave all of us the opportunity to talk. And we actually right now have a class going on right now called, I think it's Perspectives on Suffering and the Theological Perspectives on Suffering and the Role of Ritual. So there's room for that. And, you know, having a diverse group challenges some of the assumptions that we make. So this woman comes to the Episcopal service every week. And when I go around, she doesn't receive communion. But everybody has the option if they don't receive communion of having a blessing, and I bless her. But I don't bless her always in the name of God, the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. You know, I might say in the name of God. Or, you know, it's not that I'm denying being a Christian or denying Jesus. It's just I think God's at work in her the same way God is at work in everyone else in there.
So, is she a non-believer?
She's an atheist. We have a few women who are atheists, and my experience is a lot of them have been hurt by the church. And so I don't want to say, you know, I know better than they do what they believe. But what's clear to me is it's a certain image of God that they don't believe in.
You work in the prison. You also work in the cathedral.
Yes.
Which is the center of Episcopal life in North Georgia. It's a parish which is very diverse, mm-hmm. but also has a whole lot of people in it who have been very lucky in life, mm-hmm. who have a lot of things.
Right.
How do you take that prison work and bring it to what you do at the cathedral, talking to people who may be so fortunate in not having had to experience mm-hmm. what the women you work with at the prison do?
Yeah. Don't let me forget to answer that, but I want to say first, there is a lot more pain and suffering in the cathedral than people would ever know.
I didn't mean to imply that there wasn't.
But it's, you know, sometimes that's the thing about certain areas of Atlanta is there's a lot of pressure to keep that mask on. So I'll say that. But I think I do it in a lot of ways. Part of it is just who I am. I have a couple Bible studies, and I can't help but not talk about this situation with Kelly. I've been asking the staff, I've been asking the Bible studies to pray because this is someone who's very dear to me. And they've been praying. And I've had cathedral parishioners praying for me and writing me and saying, we're thinking about you during this. So part of it is just, it's part of me and it's part of what I bring and I talk about it. And I'm sort of new there, so I haven't preached very much, but it informs my sermons too. I did talk a little bit about some of my prison ministry and what I've learned from the women there in one of my first sermons there. My sermons are always informed by one of maybe the greatest lessons I've learned at the prison, which is that no one is beyond God's power of redemption. No one. And that comes out in everything I do at the cathedral, I think. At my last church, we have a group from that church who are now going out to the prison to work with the Children's Center out there, which is a great opportunity for people who want to be introduced to prison ministry. So I'm hoping that people will come with me. You can't just go out to the prison, but come with me in different ways.
Reverend, will you get to speak to Kelly before the scheduled execution, and or are you planning to attend?
I will, as long as I don't get in trouble for anything today. But yes, I should be able to speak with her before the execution. I plan to be on the premises. I don't think I'm able to witness. But yes, I'll be there with her. She's got a circle of people who have really been supporting her through this.
Reverend Kathy Zappa is an Episcopal priest who works with some of Georgia's female inmates and has worked with Kelly Gissendanner. She's also the canon for spirituality and mission at the Cathedral of St. Philip here in Atlanta. Reverend Zappa, thanks so much for your time. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening, and thank you for caring.
Thank you, Reverend.